Thank you very much, Ross, for the introduction. And thank you to you and to Food Bowl Unlimited for the invitation to come to Shepparton. Of course, nobody knew a year ago when that invitation was first issued that you'd be getting over the floodwaters of just a couple of weeks ago. But from the presentations we've just heard, it sounds as though Shepparton and the surrounding regions are well into recovering from that. In the global economy, recovery is also underway from a deluge, a different kind, a man-made one. Progress, though, has been uneven so far, and the outlook is uncertain. So I want to say a little bit about that here today and for the broader audience. It also seems, though, a fitting occasion to talk about monetary policy and the regions. A question that we're often asked is, how do we take account of the varying conditions across the country in the setting of interest rates? I want to offer a few observations about those issues today and of the issues which arise when we have one policy instrument for a fairly diverse economy. My main message there is going to be that diversity does matter, though it's often not as pronounced as people assume, because all the parts of the economy ultimately are connected. Things which happen in one place or one sector have a habit of spilling over to other areas, and furthermore, economies have a certain capacity to adjust to these differences if we let them. And in Australia, actually, that process works pretty well. So that's where I'm going. And I'm going to start, as I say, with the global economic scene. It's a mixed picture. In our region, in the Asian region, most economies have well and truly recovered from the downturn of late 2008 and 2009. The main exception to that is Japan, which is still struggling, but elsewhere, most economies are much closer to their potential growth paths now than they were a year or so back. As a result of that, policies are tending in those countries to become less accommodative. Monetary policy is tending to tighten. And as a result of that, it's likely that the growth in the next year that we see in Asia, it'll still be good, but it won't be the stellar sort of growth that we've seen in the past 12 months or so when the V shape, the upward part of the V, was in full swing. We could probably say similar things about Latin America as we could about Asia. In Europe, it's more of a mixed picture. Germany is powering ahead, and it's reaping the benefits of a decade or so of attention given to lowering costs and raising productivity. But other economies in continental Europe are nothing like as strong as Germany, and some of them, as we've been reading in the newspapers in recent months, are in the grip of a very painful transition to a world of restricted private credit and limits to the scope for budgetary flexibility. In the United States, an expansion has been underway for some time, but it seems in recent months to have just lost a little bit of steam, and growth certainly recently hasn't been robust enough to bring down an unemployment rate that's about 9.5%. In our own case, in Australia, growth's been quite solid over the past year. Unemployment is relatively low. Inflation, for the time being anyway, has come down. And things actually have been fairly favourable for us in the past few years compared with a number of other countries. Let me see if I can illustrate that. I don't normally do PowerPoints anymore, but I usually try to entertain people with my charm and wit only, but I thought I'd bring a few pictures today. I hope they're visible. I was looking at some of the other slides earlier when I found them slightly fuzzy, and I thought maybe if mine were fuzzy, that would fit, because people often are wondering what it is I really said. So fuzzy charts might go with that, but here hopefully it's reasonably clear. This is measuring GDP, and it's done per head of population, and you should do that because countries with differing population growth rates will have different growth experiences almost automatically. And we index all the figures to start at 100 in 1998. And what you can see there is Australia has tended to steal a bit of a march on most of the others here, mainly by virtue of not having had a deep downturn in the past couple of years. There's a lesson there, actually. Deep recessions like they've had in America or England or Europe are actually very damaging episodes. You can't always avoid business cycle downturns. They'll always occur. But if you can avoid having the really bad ones, that's good. So we have tended to move ahead of the pack here in a reflection of good performance. Now, to give just a little perspective, if I want to put China onto this chart, I have to expand the scale a lot. And that's how it looks. So we're still ahead of the pack of the advanced countries, but in terms of growth of GDP per head, China, of course, is growing very rapidly. Now, that's a common phenomenon. A developing country that starts with low income per head, if they adopt advanced technology and do high rates of investment and train their workers, they can catch up quite quickly to advanced country living standards. That's actually been the Asian story since World War II. And it's very much the story of China. And the point of the chart really is to say how quickly that country is growing. They've become our largest trading partner. There are probably many years of pretty quick growth in China, variable growth, and we will feel those variations. But China is and India coming along behind them, which will probably ultimately be a similar size in their economy. These developments are transforming the world economy during our lifetime in a way that has seldom happened before. So just a few pictures there. But the main task for us in Australia, of course, having done better than most countries in recent years, is to try in the period ahead to keep that solid trend in place through the various challenges which are coming at us. Now, the future is unknowable. Economic forecasts are very poor. Some of you may know I do a little bit of flying for recreation privately, so I'm a frequent user of weather forecasts. And I can tell you weather forecasts are much better than economics forecasts. In fact, there was the old joke that economic forecasters exist to make weather forecasters look good. So we do have to make forecasts, though, unfortunately, and think about how things are likely to unfold. So let me give you our take. We think the global economy will record reasonable growth in the next year, though probably not quite as quick as the past year. The speed of growth in the past year, by the way, was a surprise to many observers. We think of Australia's terms of trade, that is the relative price of our export basket compared to our import basket, which is reaching a 60-year high as we sit here today, will probably decline a little bit but remain very high by historical standards. We think that that means that income and spending in our country will tend to grow pretty strongly, even as the stimulatory effects of earlier government programs and earlier periods of low interest rates unwind, because those policies are adjusting back to normal. We think, and businesses that we talk to seem to agree, that resource sector investment, already quite high, will rise further as Australia experiences the largest minerals and energy boom for 100 years. Even with continued caution on the part of households in their spending, which we expect, that probably means that overall growth in the economy, which has in the past year been at about trend, 3.25%, will probably be something a bit higher than that in 2011. That in turn means, we think, that the fall in inflation that we've seen in recent times and which we needed probably won't go all that much further now. Of course, that central forecast could turn out to be wrong. Things could turn up to drive some other outcome. And we spent a lot of time thinking about what those things might be. They include possibly if there was a return to contraction in the United States, or the Chinese economy slowed more than currently expected, or something goes wrong in global financial markets and that affects confidence and so on. Any of these might happen. But if downside possibilities don't materialise, then the job ahead looks likely to be one of managing a fairly robust upswing. That's a problem, of course, that many other countries would love to have. Part of the task of managing that, of course, will fall to monetary policy. So what then are the goals of monetary policy? Let me talk a little bit about that. And put simply, our job is to preserve the value of money over time as far as we can by keeping inflation low and to keep the economy's growth path near its potential path so far as we can. For the past 17 years, we've been pursuing that by having a medium-term target for CPI inflation shown here in the grey shaded area. You can see that for many years prior to about 1990, inflation was quite high. A couple of quick figures here. The average for 20 years was 8% a year. At 8% a year, the value of money halves every 9 years. So 20 years of 8% inflation, your dollar's worth 21 cents at the end of that. You think about how corrosive that is for saving and so on. That's why we want low inflation. We've managed to keep on average in the target zone. It varies around, but on average over the period the outcome is more or less exactly 2.5% as it turns out. So that's our goal. How does monetary policy work? Well, we've got very effective control over just one interest rate, namely the rate at which banks lend to each other large sums of money overnight. They're lending cash, so to speak. And that's why that interest rate's called the cash rate. It's a one-day rate. And the Reserve Bank can more or less make that rate go where we think it should go. That has an impact on short-term interest rates in generally, though many other things also can have an impact, as we've seen in recent years. And because the bulk of financing activity in Australia is contracted on variable rates, that means that when we move the cash rate, most of the loan rates and deposit rates in the country will go up and down, not necessarily exactly by the same amount, but there's still a fair influence there. So through that device, we can affect the relative incentive to save or to borrow, and therefore we can affect the demand for goods and services and spending on real and financial assets. Moreover, because we've changed the rate of return on Australian assets compared to assets abroad, the exchange rate will also move when we change interest rates, though on a daily basis the exchange rate's also responding to a host of other factors, most of which don't have much to do with us, or at least not with the Reserve Bank. Often the expectation of what will happen to the cash rate in the future is just as important, even more important sometimes, than what the level is today. What the Reserve Bank says, or what people think we've said anyway, between the lines, can be very influential on markets and behaviour, and that's why central bankers, including me, are usually so guarded in things we say in public. Well, let me come to the heart of the issue then, the effects of monetary policy in a diverse economy. It's obvious, just from the condensed description I've just given you, that when we change interest rates, it's going to affect different groups in different ways. If you're a saver, you want higher interest rates. If you're a borrower, of course, you want them lower. So the bigger the size of your balance sheet, either debt or assets, the more you're going to feel the effect. If you have no saving and no debt, you probably feel more or less nothing, at least directly, with a change in monetary policy. In addition, we have only one set of interest rates for the whole country. We can't have different interest rates for Shepparton versus Melbourne. We set policy for the average Australian conditions, and of course any given region or industry may not be experiencing the average conditions. In fact, there may be no industry that's experiencing exactly the average conditions. And it's that phenomenon that people typically, I guess, have in mind when they talk of monetary policy being so-called a blunt instrument. And of course, the issue is you can't have different monetary policies by region, at least not if we're all using the one currency and if funds are free to flow around. A region that wants its own interest rate has to have its own currency, and it probably also has to have a set of regulations that stop savers in one region lending their money in another. Otherwise, you can't keep control of the rate of interest. When you think about it, a system like that is unlikely to be practical. There are costs also for having your own currency. Any region that wants its own currency has to set up its own central bank. It has to accept that when goods and people cross its borders, even to the neighbouring region, there will be transactions costs involved, which will probably inhibit trade and investment flows even within the one country. Moreover, you have to manage a currency area carefully. Many very small countries with their own currency have gotten into trouble over the years. And it's for reasons like this that there are many small countries who link their currency to a larger neighbour or even just adopt the currency of that larger neighbour outright. If you look at Europe, it's still the case that many small countries on the fringe of the euro area feel a powerful attraction to becoming part of a larger monetary union, despite the case that conditions for joining the euro area and staying in it are quite demanding, and it's recently become clear for some countries just how demanding they are. Well, there's a field of economics that thinks about all this. Apart from obvious criteria like political unity, language and culture, economists usually think that the case for a single currency in an area is stronger when, firstly, the business cycles of the various elements in the region are similar, where there's a lot of trade between various regions, where factors of production, labour and capital can freely flow across borders in response to differences in conditions, and finally, where there are other means, other policy means, mainly in the fiscal area, to respond to regional differences. So that if we take that framework, we can then ask, in effect, how does Australia rate as a single currency area? How well do we fit the various criteria? So we can ask how different are the economic events which happen across regions, how flexibly the economy responds to those, what other mechanisms are at work to respond. And then I think it's worth asking at the end, finally, after all of that, how different are the experiences in the end? Well, let me see if I can come at that. There are some events, of course, which will at least initially have an impact on one region more than another. And the one people are mostly thinking about right now, of course, is the big rise in mineral prices and the associated build-up in investment, which we saw beginning a few years ago, which temporarily abated but now is back very powerfully over the past year or so. Mineral resources are not found in abundance everywhere, and so some regions will get more of an initial kick than others. As an example, mining is 25% of the gross state product of Western Australia, and the relevant figure for Victoria is 2%. So you would think that WA, at least initially, is going to get more impulse from the mining boom than will Victoria. Well, that's true. But then, as usual, things get more complicated and more subtle when we think further. The headquarters of some important mining companies are in Melbourne. Those companies will be putting additional demands on various service providers right around the country: air travel, consultants, engineers, geologists, explorers, manufacturers. The effects of all that will be felt in other regions around the country and indeed by suppliers even outside Australia. The higher incomes generated from all this will be felt by employees, by shareholders, by governments around the country through various taxes. Depending on how those people respond or those entities respond to that flow of income, there will be then second round effects across the economy. It may well, it probably will still be the case that WA will see a bigger impetus than the rest of the country, but there will still be substantial spillovers around the country as the economy responds. Incidentally, at least until quite recently, most of the figures that we look at showed that the state in the country with the fastest rate of growth wasn't WA, it was in fact Victoria, though that is changing now. What about the second question then? What about mobility of factors of production? Well, one of the striking things of the mining boom, of course, is the fly-in, fly-out labour. I was recently in Perth Airport lining up for security behind men who were checking through the X-ray, both their laptops and their hard hats. These commutes, of course, happen from the eastern states as well. More generally, population has long shifted more or less away from the populous southeastern states and towards the resource-rich states. In fact, the mobility of the Australian workforce generally, I think, is regarded as reasonably good, perhaps not quite as mobile as the US, but much more so than Europe. Capital, of course, is particularly mobile, at least at the margin, so a fair amount of factor mobility. What about other policy mechanisms? Well, here we're talking about fiscal transfers, and there are many of those. Some of them are of a discretionary nature. Some of them are more or less automatic, and under our federal structure, there are rules about how revenue or certain parts of revenue are allocated around the states, and that's specifically designed, of course, to lessen the impact of differing economic conditions. Opinion will vary about how effective those mechanisms are, but the general point is that they're there, and they do diminish the divergences that might otherwise result from differences in conditions. So for our country, at least, the initial effects of some economic event, even if concentrated initially, do tend to be felt more generally across the economy over time. The way the economy works naturally tends to help that occur, and other policy devices also help. And that's what's supposed to happen in a well-functioning, integrated national economy. So then the final question that I want to pose is, how different are the experiences after all that has occurred? There will be some differences, and of course a lot of the mineral boom effect is still ahead, so it remains to be seen how big the differences become, but it is worth looking at how big these differences have been in the past. There's a few indicators that we could look at on a state or regional level. One of the issues here is that the more disaggregated you get, the smaller the sample sizes, so the less reliable statistical inference from the data can be. But let me take a couple of high-level indicators, one of which is consumer prices. This is the level of CPI in the capital cities. We don't have data for outside the capitals, unfortunately, for this. The point here is that the trends are quite close together for the major Australian states. In America, comparable exercise, they're actually further apart. And my technicians tell me that there may be some technical things in the way the US CPI is put together that exacerbate these differences relative to ours. And so maybe the comparison is not that different. If we look at Europe, you can see how different some of these have become. And the country at the top there is the one in the most trouble. And part of the reason for that is that their whole cost and price structure has become out of line with their competitors in Europe. And not surprisingly, they've now got troubles. And the purple at the bottom, if you can see that, is Germany, which has for some years now been running a very disciplined approach to costs and prices. And they've gained quite a considerable competitive advantage relative to other European countries, and that's part of the reason they're doing better now than those others are. But that's quite a wide spread of price performance. So my point is that compared to some other single currency areas, as best we can measure, the dispersion around the country on this metric is not that big. What about one other one, one that people care a lot about, and that's unemployment? Here, the national unemployment rate, just over 5 right now, is shown in the light-coloured line in the middle. The light lines at the top and the bottom are the highest and lowest experiences. Right now, the unemployment rate in the Hunter region of New South Wales, outside of the city of Newcastle, is recorded, at least, as pretty much zero. And the highest one is up in far north Queensland at 9 or 10%. But 80% of the country that's in the blue shaded area faces an unemployment rate between 3% and 7%. What if we did this for other countries? Well, in America we can only do it by states, at least that's the data I have. So to get a comparison, let me show this for Australia by state. More compressed because states are bigger entities and you don't get as much variation by bigger entities. If we do this for America, a fair bit more variation and much higher levels of unemployment right now because they're in recession. And if I did it for Europe, much more dispersion in the rate of unemployment. Now, in some ways, the comparison is we've got to keep in mind that the US and Europe had big recessions and dispersion of unemployment is cyclical to some extent. So it's maybe a little unfair to compare with them right now. But I think a fair conclusion is that compared with other countries that have or other regions that have a single currency, the extent of dispersion of economic experience in our country is not especially large compared with these other places. And I think that's probably a fairly reasonable conclusion to draw in general. Now, that's not to say that the differences we observe are unimportant or immaterial to people, and it's not to say that they might not get bigger at some point in the future. But I think some perspective as to how large they have been, at least up to now, is worth having. So how then does the Reserve Bank keep track of different performances? All this having been said, we do try to keep track of what's going on in the various parts of the country. For the past decade, we've put substantial resources into a liaison program, and we have people in each state capital that go around to businesses, government departments, industry associations. They talk to about 100 entities every month in order to try to find out what is happening on the ground. Some of our people were here in Shepparton only a month or so back, and one or two of you may have met them at that time. And the purpose of all that is to help us understand what's happening at the coalface, the conditions that businesses actually are experiencing, the things that worry them most. And we think that gives us a richer and sometimes more timely understanding of what is going on than the high-level official data, which has a bit of a lag, is able to do. It also gives us some sense of the likely future outcomes when we talk to businesses about their investment plans and hiring plans and so on. And this has been particularly useful, say, for the case of the mining investment build-up. Our people in the regional offices are closely in contact with the major resource producers on issues like the timing and extent of the build-up of mining investment. So these things are very helpful. And for those of you who may have met our people and given them your time, thank you for doing that, and please keep doing it into the future. Well, probably time I wrapped up, so let me conclude. As a physically large country with quite a diverse set of industries and our largest population centres, of course, a long way apart, even living in different climates much of the time, Australia is always likely to see some differences in economic experience by region. What I think is remarkable, in fact, is that in the end, the differences that we do see are not actually larger than they are. That they are not larger is testimony to the degree of flexibility within our national economy that's been built up over time, and to the design of national policies that aim to lessen the more stark differences that might otherwise occur. Those structures have grown up in the context of a national money and a national monetary policy. And it's appropriate that monetary policy is a national policy. In conducting it, the Reserve Bank does give considerable attention to finding out and understanding what the events are on the ground at a regional or industry level. And that helps us to maintain a set of financial conditions that are appropriate for the economy overall. But we know that there will always be some differences in experience and some differences in the way monetary policy changes are felt, though it shouldn't be assumed that the impacts are necessarily always greatest in country areas. Monetary policy can't, in the end, make all of those differences go away. No policy can. But in the end, if monetary policy can help to deliver reasonable macroeconomic stability, then that will offer the best chance for any region, any business, any individual to succeed on their merits. And that's the kind of country we want to have. So the Reserve Bank, taking account of all the conditions that the various sectors have and the various regions, remains very much committed to that goal. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to try and answer some questions. Thank you.
Hey Glenn, could you hypothetically speculate what a Reserve Bank governor might want in his toolbox besides a baseball bat if all the world was fixed in the
region? Most policymakers in my lifetime of being an economist have always wanted more instruments than we have. And at present, there's a big international debate actually about so-called macroprudential instruments, which means really regulatory tools to calm banks down in their lending or some other group when they get a little overexcited rather than just using the interest rate. I think there's a whole set of issues there, because I'm old enough to remember when I first joined the Reserve Bank when I had hair a long time ago. We used to tell banks who to lend to, how much, at what rate. We were, you know, a very intrusive set of regulatory arrangements, and in the end didn't work very well because an unregulated part of the system grew up and it became just as big as the banks in the end. So I think in some of the discussion about more instruments that we're seeing internationally at present, that's an experience to keep in mind. But I think, it would always be handy to have additional policy instruments, but I think we're always going to feel that even if we had one or two more, we will never have enough to have one assigned to each problem and give some theoretically optimal outcome. I don't think the world really works that way. So the best we can do is use the one instrument we do have judiciously and try to keep the overall shape of things on an even keel. Other questions?
Yes, Governor. First of all, thank you very much for coming to our region. And I hope you've sort of seen some of what we're trying to do to increase our productivity and create our future. But what I wanted to ask you was, you spoke about Germany and the measures that they'd put in place to be able to keep their economy resilient and to be able to take advantage of productivity increases and so forth. And Australia sort of had a bit of a reputation of doing that some years ago. What are the major headline things that you think we ought to be doing to make ourselves more resilient into the future in terms of being able to manage productivity increases and so forth?
I think there's a couple of dimensions to resilience, and I'd talk about those things actually a little bit separately to productivity. Productivity ultimately is about long-run living standards. That's where living standards come from. They don't come from working harder. or working more, they come from working more efficiently. And so the whole set of issues surrounding productivity, really we should think of that as surrounding, as being about long-term living standards. And I think that, I mean, I can only really speak in generalities. I couldn't recommend specific measures to people here in their own firms because I don't know enough about them. But nationally, I think labour market flexibility is important. I don't think there's any doubt that the long trend towards making the labour market less centralised, more efficient, better bargaining processes, over the long run, that paid dividends, both in terms of productivity and, I might say, of lower unemployment. So those things are important. Product markets, well, the main thing I think one wants there is competition. And I suppose people might also add today that our country, in certain respects, has maybe realised in recent years that it's a little light on the infrastructure front, and that's also important for productivity, though it's equally important that particular projects be carefully managed and costed to make sure they are going to have a payoff. So all those things matter about productivity. Resilience in the face of the kind of shocks that we've had, financial crises and so on, I think the resilience comes from we had a strong budget situation. We didn't have interest rates at rock bottom going into this episode. We were able to cut rates, therefore, quite aggressively, and that was a powerful force. The government was able to do what they did because they have very little debt, or in fact no debt, before the episode happened. So reinvesting in those things in the future is important, as I've said before. I think the strength of banks was important. So care in the way financial institutions are managed and supervised is also a factor that promotes resilience. And then I think I'd add to that, a liberal dose of good old-fashioned common sense when one of those episodes happens goes a long way as well. So those things, policy structures set for the medium term, strong financial system, and those kind of things, floating currency was also very helpful. They're the things that give you the ability to ride through the waves, and the productivity is, in the end, I guess, the average speed of the ship, so to speak. Other questions?
Yeah, Glenn, can you hear me? Yep. Two questions. Firstly, if you were to have a member of your family come along and say, Uncle Glenn, I've just bought a house and I've got a mortgage and the bank's asking me, should I lock in or take variable? What would you think or what would you say?
Well, I'd have to say no comment. To elaborate slightly without getting out of school, very few people in Australia take fixed mortgages because there's usually a cost of doing so because the yield curve slopes up, so a longer rate's lower than the short rate. But, of course, what that is the insurance policy against having to worry about it for the next 5 years. People have to make their own choice, but I'm not allowed to give financial advice, and certainly not in front of the cameras, I'm sorry.
Second question relates to your position in Australia and whether you can help with me getting a ticket to the grand final.
No, I'm no use to you there, I'm afraid. When do we have to finish, Ross? I'm here, but maybe one more, and then I'll... There's one over here.
Jacob Grieber, Bloomberg News.
Hi, Jake.
How are you? Good to see you out here. quick question about consumer spending. You've said again today it's modest. The National Accounts numbers seem to imply that it was quite strong in that last quarter. What can you tell us about that apparent... That apparent difference in the numbers and what you're saying about consumer spending?
Well, I won't get into a treatise on the innards of the national accounts here today, but we talk to 25, 30 large retailers every single month, and I think things are not as tough as they were, but not too many of them leaping for joy just at present. And I think, I still think we're probably in a period now, kind of an era, if you like, where people are going to be a bit more cautious with their spending than they were. And we're certainly making that assumption in looking into the future. I could be wrong, of course, but I think still, notwithstanding one particular quarter's data, which was boosted by one or two things which may not recur, I still think that's probably the right story thus far. And of course, as usual, we await the next data point to see whether we have to change that view.